Now, a team of UN and Red Crescent aid workers in Syria has now withdrawn from the city of Homs, having come under fire while delivering relief supplies. More than a dozen of them were trapped for hours by mortar and gunfire in a rebel-held part of the old city, which has been under siege by government forces for nearly 18 months. Despite the attacks, the team had managed to distribute some aid. Meanwhile, the talks to try to achieve a peaceful solution to the conflict in Syria, known as Geneva II, resume this week in Switzerland. I believe, Mina, you're going there tonight, is that right?
I am.
The last meeting, which took place in January, was largely viewed as achieving very little, other than the different sides in the conflict finally meeting face to face. But the talks did end with actors from all sides expressing anger and disillusionment.
The regime tried to bring other proposals to move us away from the main purpose of this meeting, which is to discuss the Geneva communique and implement the core of that communique at this point, which is to form a transitional governing body with full powers and to allow the 6 points of Geneva I to be implemented, including lifting siege from cities and towns and releasing prisoners of conscience. That has not been done so far.
I regret to tell you that we have not reached any tangible results during this week of dialogue. First, because of the lack of maturity and seriousness on the other side and their threats to derail the conference. And second, because of the flagrant intervention by the United States in the proceedings, in particular in their role advising the other side of these talks.
Well, there are still hopes that a second set of talks beginning tomorrow might achieve something more constructive. Mina, how significant was it from your experience of the first set of talks that the two sides did actually meet face to face, even though they were talking through a mediator?
There were questions whether they would actually even get to the room together. The talks were supposed to start straight away, having the two sides in the same room with Lakhdar Ebrahimi, the Arab League and UN mediator. But the first day they actually met separately and then actually came together in the same room. The fact that they actually were able to sit across the room from each other and be within the same vicinity. And also you had opposition activists and you had a pro-Syrian government activist slash media people within the same area was the first time in years that you actually were able to put them in one location where they could speak to each other. And even though some of those conversations, of course, the opposition and the government delegations, official delegations, didn't speak to each other at any point, but those that were with them and part of the entourages actually did have some interaction. And it was the first time in more than 2 years that that happened. And there is hope that as this process continues, there's some sort of empathy that develops between the two sides as seeing each other as humans again, rather than just as enemies.
I'm glad you mentioned that word. We're going to talk about the concept of empathy in a moment with an author who knows an awful lot about it. But people in peace talks always say that this is a prerequisite for any success, that one side must be able, even for a fleeting moment, to put itself in the shoes of the other.
Mm-hmm. And at the moment, that seems very, very far from where the two sides are. However, the hope is that as these rounds of talks, and it is expected to be 1 week on, 1 week off in terms of the talks, to develop that sort of basic touch of seeing the other person as a human again.
Let's talk to a man who believes that empathy can change the world. This is Roman Krznarek. He's a popular philosopher and author of a new book called Empathy, A Handbook for Revolution. He joins me on the line from our studio in Oxford. Welcome to the programme, Roman.
Thanks very much for having me on.
You're welcome. Can empathy really help, do you think? First of all, let's start with this crisis in Syria. How essential is it going to be?
Well, it's interesting that when most people think about empathy, which is the art of stepping into someone else's shoes and looking the world through their eyes, they tend to see it as a bit of a nice, soft, fluffy concept. But actually, looking through history, empathy has been incredibly powerful as a force for creating political change. Look at the South African transition where Nelson Mandela tried to step into the shoes of his white South African adversaries, and even in the Rugby World Cup in 1995, put on a Springbok jumper, which was the like putting on the enemy enemy's uniform and told white black South Africans to support an all-white rugby team, a hated symbol of apartheid. So there's a real question of whether empathy can work somewhere like Syria. And of course, Syria is an incredibly intractable and difficult problem like all wars. And as Mina was saying, there are these small signs that there's a bit of humanization going on in the process. And peace processes always have this slow recognition that between the two sides, that the other side actually maybe share some of the same problems, they share the same pain and the same blood. And they're very practical things that have been done in many peace processes just to inch that process of trust building further. I remember back in the 1990s in Guatemala, in the peace processes to end the 36-year civil war, they started getting the adversaries, the government and the guerrillas, to sit interspersed in between each other rather than opposite sides of the table. And that really started making a difference.
Unfortunately, empathy is something you can obviously switch on and switch off. And mostly in conflicts, it's switched off. You've talked in your book about empathy helping end slavery, but it didn't stop slavery beginning, did it?
No, it didn't. And sometimes empathy actually comes in after, difficult processes have happened. And one of its big roles in peace processes is actually in grassroots reconciliation and peace building between neighbors on the ground after peace processes happened. For example, in Rwanda, there's an amazing project called, it's actually a radio soap opera called Musikoea, which means New Dawn. And 90% of the population listen to it, and it's full of empathic messaging. It's about Hutu and Tutsi villagers trying to get on and avoid conflict. It mirrors the conflict that led up to the genocide in 1994. And I think in any post-conflict situation, this kind of empathic peace building is essential to dissipate the toxic us versus them mentality that creates conflict.
I think it's interesting that you've come upon this subject partly because as a child, you didn't consider yourself a very empathetic, is that the word, person?
That's right. Actually, my mother died when I was 10 years old. And like I think a lot of children who experience trauma, I went very much into my own cocoon, into my own self. I didn't cry much. I didn't laugh much. I didn't connect much with others. And only after researching empathy for many years did I realize that actually I was trying partly to recover the empathic self that I'd lost as a child. But I also had other experiences like being a human rights observer during Guatemala's civil war, which opened my eyes to empathy and how different people's lives can be and the suffering they have on the ground.
Christopher Dickey, it's interesting that when you were asked about empathy before, when you knew we were going to talk about it on this program, you said it was part of the problem as well as the solution. What do you mean?
Well, you know, I was just reading Roman's book this morning, and I think it's really an excellent book. And journalists are very empathetic. I think if you do what we do, you have to understand the way lots of people feel in lots of different circumstances.
Or at least pretend to successfully.
Well, no. I mean, I think there's more to it than that. I think it's partly a creative act, and I think that's something that Roman talks about. But what I was talking about earlier was this question of not just of empathy, but of sympathy. And one of the things that concerns me about the United States and its foreign policy is that a lot of people feel short-term empathy and sympathy. I know the two things are different, but often they're allied. In the United States, when they see people suffering, and they see, they say, I feel that suffering, I want to do something about it. But it is a transient emotion. It doesn't stay. And one of the results is that a lot of effort gets poured into aid, into assistance, and often into wars, but then it passes and people turn the page in the United States.
Christopher, Roman, I beg your pardon. Neuroscientists say that 98% of people are wired to feel empathy. Is life so much worse for those 2% who apparently can't share another person's feelings and might make life simpler in lots of ways?
Well, it's certainly the case that there's a growing recognition that empathy is actually part of what gives us well-being. You know, 1 in 4 people in the Western world say that they're lonely, and empathy is one of those cornerstones of human connection, that it makes us feel bonded to other people, whether it's relationships with family members or with strangers. But as Christopher says, there is this problem that of whether empathy is too fleeting. We see an image of suffering in a drought in sub-Saharan Africa or a war in the Middle East, and we may have concern for a moment, and then it dissipates because other things start taking over. And that's part of the reason I think that it's very important for empathy to be taught. We have to realize our empathic potential, bring our neural circuitry to life. I mean, there are fantastic school programs such as The Roots of Empathy, which has been taught to over 500,000 children around the world. It started in Canada, where children learn to empathize. They actually bring a baby into the classroom and school kids sit around the baby and try and think, talk about why is the baby crying, why is the baby laughing, and it increases social cooperation, reduces bullying, but it's part of long-term empathy building, so we don't just feel it for a moment.
The head of the negotiating team for the opposition, Hadil Bahra, said to me, you negotiate with your enemies, you don't negotiate with your friends. And so I wanted to ask you about when you see the other person as your enemy and realize that they see you also as their enemy, how do you then try to go to the next stage?
I'm afraid you're going to have to be very quick.
Well, Gandhi famously said, who was a Hindu, he said, I am a Muslim and a Hindu and a Christian and a Jew. He saw that reconciliation required empathizing with your enemies. How do you actually do that? I think you actually have to see them as human beings. If I had different parties in a war together, I'd actually bring their families together and get them to realize that they all have children, that they've all suffered the same pain and they share the same blood. That's the beginning of reconciliation. Otherwise, they just call each other terrorists and dictators.
Roman Krznarek, author of Empathy, A Handbook for Revolution. Thank you very much for coming on Weekend. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley. Now, for some people, recording odd sounds and playing around with the mix is a pleasant hobby. For Glenn Freemantle, responsible for the sound design of the hit film Gravity, it's part of a glittering career in the movie industry. His work on Gravity has earned him BAFTA and Academy Award nominations. Chris Vallance went to meet him.
Explore's been hit. Explore, do you read? Explore, over. Explore. Astronaut is off structure. Dr. Stone is off structure.
When we get a film, it has to have a concept of sound for it. I mean, they shoot on the floor, and basically when you get that film in, it's in a very rough state because it's all different locations and everything. And nearly all the time, the only thing you really, really want to keep out of that as much as you can is the dialogue.
Sound designer Glenn Freemantle, for the film Gravity, he created a soundscape out of very, very thin air.
Yes, yeah, call me, I'm detached. I don't know, I'm spinning, I can't.
We recreate everything, because cinema is about a little bit more than you hear in real life. Everything has a detail. You know, the camera might go and you want to have more detail in that. So you need control over everything. To create these films, you need control of every single sound. We're in Sound 24, my company at Pinewood Studios, where we got 28 Days Later, The Beach, An Education, 127 Hours.
And fantastic soundscape around us as we're going.
Hundreds of them. Yeah, that's the new film we're just designing at the moment.
But Gravity presented a particular problem. In space, as Alien reminded us, no one can hear you scream. So the filmmakers imagined the sound effects you hear were vibrations, audible to Sandra Bullock's character when she touched an object.
So when she touches, obviously she's got air in her suit, so she would feel the vibrations so we could hear through her. So they got hold of NASA, and they explained to us the tools they use, where they use, but they're like, they use them in car manufacturer. One of my friends works for General Motors, and he got us into General Motors today, and we went in there with all these contact mics, and that record through vibration. You stick them on and you record through the vibrations.
It sounds a bit like this. My name is Neva Deary, part of the sound design team and the re-recording mixer on Gravity. And then what we did, we went and manipulated the sound, so recorded the normal sounds through contact mics and vibration microphones. So what we ended up at the end is with this.
We started trying to do these movements, and we put at some of the times we had this acoustic guitar in a big tub of water. We put mics on the guitar, you know, the contact mics, and you record through this medium and then through the water to get these weird sounds. We even recorded through this mic that they used for oil exploration.
And a new technology, Dolby Atmos, meant the sound effects could move in three dimensions throughout the cinema, following the action.
Mind if I join the fun?
Certainly.
How you feeling?
And then there's the futz, a technical term
for making dialogue sound thin and crackly, like a spacesuit radio.
So the film doesn't have only all these dynamics with it. It is continuously moving. It always has the futz. It always has... But wherever Sandra is in relation to George, George at those points, wherever they are in the screen or in the distance, that replicates in the cinema. So you become in the middle of it.
One of the things you learn in the job that I do is that things sometimes don't sound like they sound. So, for example, I mean, I think the classic one for me is if you just record the sea, it can just sound like white noise.
Yeah. The devil isn't about the detail of everything. It's like one sound by itself, most of the time, is beautiful, but it doesn't give you the you know, that sharp sound image that you want. You know, like in car chases, you had animals, you know, exhaust, you know, like tigers. And
in a car chase, you'll be adding sounds that originated as growls into...
Yeah, you can, yeah. You should, those big cuts, you cut down to it and the car goes vroom. You might, you know, part of that, the engine goes vroom, but you might have a sort of like a pitched down tiger there that does it as well. It's escapism within the film. And everything becomes slightly hyper-real at times. Gee, how we'd do a car chase is we would cut. They're so dynamic. You cut from the exhaust to the tyre to that, follow the gearbox down, like, and then you hear the crankshaft turn, and then you go to another sound. And the reason you do that is because you've got to have energy. It's got to have excitement. It's got to be bigger than you know, driving your Ford Escort down the road. It's got to be amazing, you know what I mean?
You've used your own voice as well.
Yeah, I did, yeah, quite a lot of times, actually, yeah. In 28 Days Later, I use that a lot. I mean, things that mixed with cats and various bits and pieces.
So you've been various monsters in your career.
I have done, yeah.
It's very much, it sounds like a performance. You are effectively, you and your team are actors in this movie, in the movies you work in.
Yeah, I suppose we are in a way, yeah. You know, I mean, we're all performers. And by the time it's finished, you know, you feel the film. You know, the sense is that you feel this film, if it feels right or it feels wrong. So I always think you don't only listen with your ears, you also listen with your heart.
Glenn Fremantle talking there to Chris Vallance. Wow, the artifice of it. Christopher Dickey in Paris. I learn everything, new things about you every time you're on. You went to film school, I hear, so this must resonate with you.
Well, it does. And, you know, one of the things that fascinated me when I was in film school was the way the soundtrack would affect your emotions as you listen. Not just the music, which everybody knows about, but the way the sound of, say, shoes walking down a hallway introduces a character before that character appears. And if you look at a film, classic horror film like The Exorcist, if you listen to it, it's every bit as scary as if you watch it.
Interesting insight, Mina, to the power of sound in film.
Absolutely, in film and also in radio. As a print journalist, I always love radio because of how much focus there is on sound. Any package that is done, whether, for
we're
example...
We're not allowed that level of artifice, though, are we?
No, but it's always
certainly
interesting.
No growling tigers in news reports.
True, but, you know, coffee machines, the amount of times I've met with radio journalists where we're having a discussion and they want to create an almost atmosphere of informality. There's a sound of, you know, a coffee machine preparing cappuccino before you come in and have a conversation. But you're right, of course, in sound, it's much more accentuated and much more important to create an atmosphere, especially if you're in space.
Does it make you want to see Gravity?
Yes, actually. I haven't seen it yet, and this does actually make me think there's more to it.
You liked it, didn't you, Chris?
I did like it, but listening to this this presentation, I think, you know, I liked it a lot because of the sound. But the visual effects are spectacular, but dizzying. They're almost hard to watch.
This is a little bit of the music from the film Gravity, as opposed to the sound effects. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Weekend. The news is coming up.